Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. Well, today we have with us a Mr. Robert Bickell. And, of course, shortly after the September 11th terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, Mr. Bickell was asked to act as an investigator and legal analyst for the law firm of John Michael Johnston of Oklahoma City to determine the potential investigative and legal aspects of the attack. Now, the focus was directed towards the sponsorship of the terrorists and, of course, going into a timeline of what this was really all about. And you can't understand the first attack or the second attack on the World Trade Center unless you understand the first attack on the World Trade Center and the fact that the government has been lying to you since that time. Oh, yes, they caught a couple of Muslim extremists in New York after the February 1993 attack, and they put them in jail. And the same thing happened after the attack on the Oklahoma City building, the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. They caught Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, and that's it. That's all there was to it. No foreign involvement at all, and they're simply lying to you. Why? Because it wasn't time yet to go to war in the Middle East. But, of course, both of those attacks, the first World Trade Center bombing that killed six people and injured 1,000 and did somewhere between $250 million of damage, and the destruction of the Murrah building that killed 168 Americans, both of them had a strong tie to the Islamic terrorist movement, and the government intentionally and purposely and maliciously covered that up. And that's what Bob Bickell has been doing, is getting to the bottom of that story. So why don't you tell us what you've discovered and how this all fits together?
Well, I think the area to begin in, Dr. Stan, is that people need to understand that the first attack on the World Trade Center, the planning for it, a lot of that all started all the way up through the bombing in Oklahoma City, all started in the Philippines and much earlier in the 1990s. Terry Nichols came into contact with Ramzi Yousef in December of 1991.
All right, now who was Ramzi Yousef and why is he important?
Ramzi Yousef was a Iraqi agent. Actually, he bounced back and forth, kind of like the little ball you see on TV, between the Iraqis and then being farmed out to the Al-Qaeda. He had been associated with Iraqi intelligence and Iraqi Secret Service for some number of years prior to his involvement in the 1991 or the 1993 February attack, bombing attack against the World Trade Center. Going back as early as the middle 1980s, acting as an agent of Iraq in terrorist activities, and also he was named as a conspirator and collusionist with the Iraqi military by the Minister of the Interior for Kuwait in the invasion of Kuwait with Iraq.
Well, now, what was his relationship to Osama bin Laden?
His real relationship with Osama bin Laden started on a familial basis. His uncle and several of his brothers served with bin Laden in the Afghan wars against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan.
All right, so that was in, of course, the mid-1980s. Towards the war ended in 1988, the peace agreement 1989. So here you've got Ramzi Yousef, and he's tied to the Iraqis, and then he's over in the Philippines in the early 1990s plotting blowing up American buildings. And he's meeting with Terry Nichols in 1991?
In 1991, on December the 17th, Terry Nichols, Ramzi Yousef, Wali Khan, Hakeem Murad, one other American that has originally been identified by a intelligence agent for the Philippines, identified this other American as John Lepney, L-E-P-N-E-Y.
Do we know who he is?
Lepney, since that time, I was able to gain access to some other files. And as it turns out, John Lepney was a alias. And then when we were going through the throes of trying to figure out who Lepney actually was, we traced him to another alias of Augusto Barino. And then we were finally able to determine through another interview that was conducted over there where John Lepney, a.k.a. Augusto Barino, was actually identified by Lisa Torres, who was Marifae Nichols' sister, as being Tom Shelton.
All right,
Tom Shelton is as an American. Tom Shelton was the owner and operator of Paradise Shelton Tours, which is the group that Terry Nichols signed up with to make his first trip to the Philippines looking for a Filipino mail-order bride.
All right, fine. So here we have Terry Nichols over there in 1991 meeting with Ramzi Yousef, who in 1993 would blow up the World Trade Center. In 1995, he would certainly be involved in this plan to blow up American airliners, 11 of them over the Pacific, and, of course, with Operation Bojinka, which included hijacking American planes and flying them into the World Trade Center, the White House, the Pentagon, the Sears Tower, and the Trans-America building in San Francisco. And, of course, the CIA's done everything they could to cover that fact up, that they knew about the second plan to attack the World Trade Center back in 1995. So did the government know about this meeting in 1991? And if they did, why have they covered all this information up?
Well, you know, why they did it is a question that myself and numerous other people have been asking. And most recently, it's been being asked by Senator Specter, Harlan Specter of Pennsylvania.
And the English side, but there was articles in the London Times this last week about this whole, Murrah building, connection to Iraq and and those meetings over in the Philippines.
Right. Well, the big problem is they're asking the wrong question.
We're going to have to take a quick break here. When we get back, we'll try to ask the right questions. But right now, of course, I want to tell you about a couple of items. One of them, of course, is called Be Alive Royal Jelly, and we've certainly used this in our family for the last 8 to 10 years. It's designed simply to give you extra energy, and, of course, you take it on a daily basis. It's the royal jelly that the queen bee eats, and of course she lives to be 6 years old, and the average bee lives about 6 weeks, so there's got to be something good in it. At least it's great for bees. And the amazing thing is that people have used this, and you've used it for years, and really seems that it helps them. So if you'd like to know more about this compound, it comes in capsule form, comes in many forms, but Be Alive Royal Jelly is a Christian company. I've very, very proud to use their products for many years, and they recently asked us if they could sponsor us for a month, so I certainly agreed. Their telephone number is 1-866-233-7500. That's 1-866-233-7500, and of course we want to point out that if you're not completely pleased at the end of 3 months, why, they'll refund your money. That's Be Alive Royal Jelly, and if you'd like to try their products, why, I think that you'll be pleased with them. And then, of course, we want to also mention the Big Berkey filter. It's a water filter. Unfortunately, it's not available in California or Iowa, but it's available all across the rest of the country. It is certainly economical. It's convenient. It's powerful. It's elegant. It's flexible. And basically, you put the water in the top, you filter it out the bottom, and, of course, it comes out sparkling clear. It's the ultimate water filter, or nearly markets at $279. Right now, you can get it for $249. And if you call 888-803-4438 and mention that you heard it from Dr. Stan, you'll get two sport filtration bottles that are worth $70 at no extra charge. That's 888-803-4438, 803-4438, and call right now. Have you ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam, in Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in
Russia in Siberia at the end of the Second World War. Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City, what really happened with TWA 800 that went down off the eastern coast about a year ago? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are well covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working on the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, this book has been suppressed very effectively across America. It's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book I know that'll give you more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now.
Well, Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is Bob Bickle, and of course he's a friend of Craig Roberts, who's a very, very frequent guest on our program, and you and Craig are actually writing a book, aren't you?
Right. We're doing a book. It's in, you know, kind of the final throes of being put together. There's a lot of editing work to be done on some of this stuff, and fortunately, Craig is a better editor than I am with regard to those things. So I'm trying to get things finished up to put in his hand for the final editing on the book.
All right. Well, we were talking about the fact that nobody's asking the right questions. Now, basically, there was a tie-in between the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the bombing of the Murrah Building in April of 1995, and the second attack on the World Trade Center in September of the year 2001. But, of course, the government knows about these other tie-ins, and they have concealed this. Of course, they do not want the American people to know how it all ties together. And you said we were asking the wrong question. What's the right question?
Well, the right question is, and it has to go back to the history of Terry Nichols in the Philippines and why no one wants to discuss that openly. There's a great deal of focus being placed on the work of Jaina Davis, you know, revolving around the Oklahoma City bombing and her identification of some Iraqis that were resident in that area and their association with another individual who is a member of the PLO. And those are good, solid leads, and she's done a great deal of really fine work on that. The problem is that after you take all of that work, take all of those details and set it out on the table, it looks like a rock sitting on 500 miles of beach sand. There's not a cliff anywhere on the horizon that rock would associate with or attach to. And the problem becomes, why is there not anyone, or why previously has no one bothered to try to put Terry Nichols in the midst of these things? The entire premise of the government's prosecution of Nichols and McVeigh was built around Lee Harvey McVeigh, the lone bomber, and his faithful sidekick, Terry Nichols. But Terry Nichols was in the Philippines much earlier than any of this stuff ever came on anybody's radar screen, and actively involved. After his meeting in December of 1991, he made an agreement, according to the statements by Filipino intelligence operatives, where he agreed to support Ramzi Yosef and actually participated in the logistics of procuring chemical explosives and other materials, up to and including a significant amount of weaponry for the terrorists in the Philippines, all the way through from that first meeting on through the early stages of the planning for the first World Trade Center attack. And then, of course, there were a number of terrorist attacks that were carried out in the Philippines prior to the Oklahoma City bombing. And the Oklahoma City bombing itself was only one part of what came to be known as Project Bojinka.
All right. And, of course, there's so many aspects to this. And one of them, of course, is the fact that Edward Angeles, who was the co-founder of ABU-CF, the Philippine terrorist organization, was actually a Philippine government agent. And, of course, we find out recently that after this terrible bombing over in the Bali, there's some suggestion that the Indonesian military actually sold the explosives to the terrorists. We're not getting the full story at all about what's going on in the world today. And certainly the relationship between Terry Nichols and, of course, the Islamic terrorists is not being fully brought out at all. So why is the government trying to keep that from the American people? You would think that right now they would want a good excuse to go after Osama bin Laden. Here you can tie Ramzi Yousef and the first World Trade Center bombing and the second world and the Murrah building bombing to Iraq. So why don't we bring that out to say, yeah, we got to go after the wicked Saddam Hussein? He was involved in that. Doesn't make sense, does it? Any more than the fact that we specifically left Saddam Hussein in power in 1991 and in 1993 and 1995 when the Iraqi military wanted to overthrow him, why we betrayed them and turned their names over to Saddam Hussein. And now, of course, we want to send our boys over to die to overthrow Saddam Hussein. None of this makes sense, Bob.
Well, the problem that I have with it, and of course, I was actively involved in investigations of the Iraqi procurement network prior to the invasion of Kuwait, long before we even thought that there was going to be an invasion of Kuwait, or anybody else did either for that matter.
This was in the late 1980s and early in 1990, was it?
89, 90, and 91. Okay. And then, you know, eventually it became a situation where even after the invasion of Kuwait, of course, there were congressional investigations into some of the activities revolving around the supply of Iraqi, you know, or weaponry to the Iraqis, or weaponry technology, and then the financing and how the financing actually came about, not only through contacts in the United States, but a number of other places.
Well, where did the financing for the Iraqi military come from?
Well, initially it was coming from Iraqi oil, and they were spending something approaching 60% of their oil revenue on building up their weaponry. They were also having problems at a given point with their ability to secure loans through the World Bank or through other countries that would extend them credit. The Italians had extended them a great deal of credit. The French had extended a great deal of credit. And they were spending so much money on weaponry that their oil revenues would not cover everything that they were spending. So they started looking to other sources, and one of the sources became the American Treasury Department in the form of agricultural loans. Those loans were eventually tracked to the point that we could determine that where that money was being loaned by the Agricultural Department to supposedly procure food items for the Iraqi populace, the food was going to Jordan and a couple of other places, and it would go into a warehouse. Another transaction would take place where that money, it wound up being food for money or food for weaponry exchanges taking place, and then the weaponry would go into Iraq and the food would go out the back door to someplace else.
Well, now, why were we financing Iraq when they were making billions of dollars every, countless billions of dollars every month on their oil and putting it into weapons? Why would we give them additional money? That doesn't make sense.
Well, the reality of that situation was that we were in the process of creating our own 900-pound gorilla. Of course, everybody will remember that we had the Iranian seizure of our embassy, and then, you know, after the overthrow of the Shah, and then Khomeini came back into power. And, of course, that cost Jimmy Carter his presidency. And then when Reagan took over, our people were released. But at that point, it became a thing that was referred to as the level battlefield doctrine that was initiated under the Reagan administration. It was essentially a secret policy initiative based on keeping the Iranians under control and tied up in a war of attrition between the Iranians and the Iraqis. And so we were trying to keep our thumb on the Iranians without stepping in with our own personnel, and it became a war our war being fought by the Iraqis.
And once again, it doesn't make sense because we brought the Ayatollah the Khomeini to power when we intentionally and purposely and knowingly toppled the Shah of Iran. So it almost appears that, first of all, we create the Iranian enemy, then we create the Iraqi enemy, like we're just creating enemies all over the world.
Well, the reality of that situation is that the United States State Department has been for a long period of time, no matter who was in power in the White House, essentially leaderless and rudderless and without any moral compass whatsoever.
Well, I would agree they don't have a moral compass, but the people who lead it always come from the Council on Foreign Relations, which is an extension of a British secret society. I think they know what they're doing. I think they just want the American people to know. Because
you would think
occasionally they'd make a mistake in our favor.
Well, if they do anything in our favor, it's typically very much a mistake.
Right.
And a good portion of our diplomacy, as it is exercised from the State Department, are really more often extensions of the British worldview of things, and more than anything else, the British colonial extension.
Well, that was the whole idea that Cecil Rhodes and his secret society, which became, in America, the Council on Foreign Relations.
Right. Well, the area that we really, get into with all of this, and there are so many varied issues. When we start dealing with the situation with the Oklahoma City bombing, in reality, of course, we had 168 people lose their lives. You've still got the survivors of those particular people who died. You've got a wider number of people who were injured and who had, suffered substantial loss in any number of ways. But Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh are essentially so far down the food chain and what created this world of terrorism that we're now embattled against.
We're going to have to interrupt you there. We'll be right back, and I want to pick up on that idea as soon as we get back here.
Yes, sir.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course the Oklahoma City bombing has never really been settled. There's so much you have never heard about the fact that the government had foreknowledge of that, and of course you'll hear that in my Oklahoma City Update 4-tape set. We'll actually hear the attorney, Clark Brewster, who defended a young woman named Carol Howe, who is a government informant who told the government they're going to bomb the Murrah Building. And so how did they reward her? Why, they trumped up charges. They wanted to send her to prison and destroy her life because they did not want the American people to learn the truth. We have a 4-tape set on Oklahoma City bombing. We have an Oklahoma City update. We have an Oklahoma City special. And let me suggest that to you. It's 2 4-tape sets and 2 videos. And I think there's you'll never look at the world through the same eyes again. If you get the Oklahoma City special, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. You can get either one or both videos separately. You can get one or both tape sets separately. But if you get them all together, they're only $69.95. We pay the postage. You need to understand the background of what you're talking about. And if you'd like, we'll get you a free copy of this program today. And, of course, just specifically request this. We'll throw that in with you because, of course, the Oklahoma City bombing ties right into the World Trade Center bombing in September of this year. And the fact most people don't know that simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. Call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for the Oklahoma City tapes or the special.
Could you believe that there is an organized effort to dumb down children all across America? As we see falling SAT scores, it's very easy to say, well, gee, we need to just spend more money. That'll solve our problem. Ladies and gentlemen, that won't solve the problem at all because there is an organized program within the hierarchy of education to dumb down our children intentionally. Outcome-based education is a fascinating book written by Pamela Hobbs-Hofker and Pat Lutzik, going into the background of the program of the humanists who gained control of the educational establishment in the United States to change the attitude of our children, to change their attitude towards God and family and country. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for outcome-based education. Once you understand what they're doing to your children, you'll never look at the world through the same eyes again. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here, and for those of you who heard our offer discussion of the Oklahoma City Special, there's a book that goes with that. It was written by Jim Keith, and Jim Keith was a very, very prolific writer, and a nice, healthy young man, and shortly after he wrote a book about the Oklahoma City bombing, he died while having arthroscopic surgery. Now, I've done, when I was practicing orthopedics, literally hundreds and hundreds, if not over 1,000 arthroscopic surgeries of one sort or another. Nobody ever died on the operating table, but Jim Keith, who wrote the book OKC Bombing, did die on the operating table as a very young, healthy man. And of course, that's part of the Oklahoma City Special. We'll let you go ahead and pick up the story there, Bob. And you were beginning to say that you felt that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols were far down the food chain as far as what really happened. If they were far down the food chain, who was at the top of the food chain?
At the top of the food chain is Saddam Hussein in one square, the Iraqi Mukhabarat, who is their secret service, and the Iraqi Mukhabarat is in charge of not only security within the country, but also keeping their expatriates under control all around the world.
But, of course, Osama bin Laden fits into this someplace, doesn't he?
Well, Osama bin Laden is essentially a hired gun. Osama bin Laden has his own agenda, which is basically can be described as having taken over the original communist declaration of world domination through Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, basically what he wants is an Islamic world under his control. He would be the leader of that.
He would be one of them. And so you have these two different squares who have mutually acceptable agendas. They don't necessarily like each other, and they don't necessarily get along, and they certainly don't trust each other on any number of occasions, but they will rely on each other for the outcome that they want to generate that is somewhat mutual in their own eye.
But, of course, Ramzi Yousef was tied to both Iraq and to Osama bin Laden. In fact, when he was finally captured in Pakistan in 1995, he was staying in a hostel that was controlled by one of bin Laden's companies. So there's a tie into both sides. And
right.
That, of course, is what people don't understand.
Well, it's difficult to understand that, you know, everybody wants to focus on Terry Nichols, and that's a good place to start. But to really get a grasp on this, and this is something I spent a year looking for, there had to be one linchpin that held everything together. And I originally started doing a timeline with all of these various terrorist attacks that started back shortly after the invasion of Kuwait and come forward to September the 11th. And I kept looking for something that appeared to be there just in the observation of it, and that was that there had to be a singular mind at work or ruled by committee or what have you. And I kept looking at the early stages where you saw Ramzi Yousef in any number of places. He was conducting bombing raids, terrorist attacks in Thailand, in Bangkok, Thailand. He was in there to do a bombing attack, and, of course, it went wrong, and a traffic accident that stopped the bomb delivery vehicle from getting to the place that it was supposed to go, which was going to be either the American embassy or the Israeli embassies, which are only, you know, not too far apart, a couple of blocks apart. Then you go forward to that from that particular time all the way to 1994. After the World Trade Center bombing, he was back in Pakistan, or actually in the area that country that he's from over there, right there around Pakistan, where his entire family's from, and he was conducting an attack against a Iranian mosque in Mashhad, Iran.
Is that what, Balochistan he's from?
In Baluchistan. Yeah, I was trying to say Belarus.
And, right.
there's too many of these names that go to running together for me after a year.
But they always end with Stan. That's
right. It was, but nonetheless, it becomes a situation where you go to looking at these different terrorist attacks up through 1995 from the World Trade Center and previous to that, then to the other areas that he was launching terrorist attacks out of, then to the World Trade Center in 93, then on up through Project Bojinka, and all of a sudden you've got this whole cluster of things. Project Bojinka was supposed to, it was a real mixed bag of things that were all being planned under one central kind of control and command situation. He was planning the assassination of Pope John Paul II. That was to happen in the second week of February, second week of January. He was also planning and had planned and had looked into the potential, and they actually had gained a great deal of intelligence that the terrorists had with regard to the route that President Clinton would take on his trip to the Philippines. So, President Clinton was a target of assassination, and they looked at using handheld rockets and RPGs, the handheld grenade launchers, a number of other different things to possibly assassinate Clinton during his trip over there. Then there was, of course, they were going to pull off the plan that would involve crashing or bombing 12 American airliners that would have taken out 4,000 to 5,000 people. So, that particular situation was one thing. Terry Nichols was involved in planning meetings in the Philippines with Ramzi Yosef and others, where they were actually determining this wide list of targets. And Terry Nichols was specifically supposed to help acquire information and intelligence on potential targets in the United States at that time. So, and of course, we know through testimony and other documents that in July of 1993, Hakeem Murad actually did surveillance of the World Trade Center and gathered a great deal of information specifically for Ramzi Yosef in the attack that was actually done, against the World Trade Center at that time.
And, of course, for our listeners, Murad was one of these people meeting with Terry Nichols. Murad was eventually apprehended in 1995 when the Operation Bojinka was over, was recognized, and now he is, of course, in a U.S. jail, and he even talked about, of course, this plan, to hijack planes and fly them into our building. So our government was well aware of that.
Well, they were not only well aware of it, they were given copies. If you take a look at a very small snapshot of the timeline of what was transpiring and taking place, and I need to correct one statement I made. I said July of 93. It was July of 92 that Hakeem Murad was doing the surveillance of the World Trade Center.
Because the bombing was in February of 93, right?
Right. And so I misspoke on that. I just needed to correct myself before somebody else did it for me.
We won't let them.
I'm trying to stay on my toes with all the dates and the names of the places. The big issue became a situation in some of the reports that had been released to the public from various intelligence and police sources, in statements specifically from the Filipino National Police Intelligence Command, that they had, in one instance, there's one report floating around where they made the statement that they had received a tip-off that there was going to be an assassination plot carried out against the Pope during his trip. They had people specifically in place already penetrated in these terrorist groups, Edwin Angeles being one of them. The reports that I have in my possession would indicate that Angeles quite possibly was the source of that tip. Publicly, they have said that it came from a foreign intelligence source. Who knows? It, you know, it could be one, it could be the other. But they still had the information.
And Angeles was actually the co-founder of Abu Sayyaf, wasn't he?
Right. Angeles was a very interesting character. Angeles has been, attempts have been made to discredit Angeles. If you study Edwin Angeles and look into his history and his background, his grandfather, General Dugasan, was a general in the Moro National Liberation Front, which is the one of the Islamic separatist movements in the Philippines throughout that region. Dugasan was a general when Angeles was a very, very young child. He was on the ground. He was battling the Filipinos for the separatist cause of the Islamic community there in that region. One of his uncles is a street parliamentarian, a very well-respected and very well-known street parliamentarian in the southern part of the Philippines in the Islamic community. Two of his mother's brothers were killed in a clash with the Philippine military when they were recruited under Fidel Ramos, not Fidel Ramos, but Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos, came up with a plan where he was going to take back the island of Sulu from Malaysia, from Indonesia. He recruited 69 Muslims to take to another island and to have those individuals trained for the invasion of Sulu. They found out what the plan was, rebelled against their trainers, and were machine gunned to death. All but one of them were killed. Two of the 68 that were killed were uncles of Edwin Angeles. So he was recruited, as it turns out, in 1988, trained and put in place for the purposes of penetrating these Muslim insurgency groups and organized crime groups who operate with the insurgents and with the terrorists, and to be able to gather intelligence and at different times to put into place plans that would destabilize various operations of these various Muslim groups, MILF, and others.
All right, we're going to have to take another quick break here, and of course, this is the time, first of all, I want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Where are you going to hear information like this? You're not going to get it from the controlled media. The thing that got me involved in this whole battle 40 years ago was a realization that the media was not telling us the truth, that somebody had played games with my mind at the university and the medical school, and we had not gotten the truth about so many issues. And once you begin to understand that the people, of course, who write the history books do not determine what happened in the past. They give you the view that you were supposed to believe about this, how things fit together. And, of course, they never expose the Brotherhood of Darkness and the people who really run the world. Well, we hope, of course, that many of you want to join the Radio Liberty family, and for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you'll get our four best tapes of the month, you'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you'll be helping us do what we do, and that is bring the truth to people across America on 50 stations or outlets every week. And we are gradually growing, but quite frankly, we need your help to continue doing what we're doing. So we hope many of you will decide to join with us. And then, of course, it's our contention that we're moving into a very, very serious situation with the war in the Middle East that will eventually, in one way or another, precipitate the Third World War. And then we're moving into difficult financial times. We are going to have people understand how to look after their health, because even the health care structure in the United States is beginning to crumble because of government interference. And so we are going to put on a full-day seminar out at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course on Saturday, the 23rd of November. And we hope many of you will want to come. Doors will open at 8 o'clock, start at 9:15. We'll go to 5 o'clock. There will be a luncheon. There will be a syllabus. And we're going to talk about a preparation for the times that lie ahead. Financial preparations, because if you don't understand what's happening, you're going to be wiped out financially, and all the things that you think give you security in the way of bonds and annuities could very well be lost. And then, of course, we're going to talk about health and health matters. And then we're going to talk about the spiritual battle in which we're engaged. So if you're interested in knowing about preparation for what lies ahead, we'd love to see you at this conference, all-day-long conference sponsored by Radio Liberty. That's the 23rd of November. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We have to know how many people are going to be there because there's going to be a lunch to be made by the people at the golf course. Again, the number to call, 1-800-544-8927, or if you want to write, Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063.
Our 4-tape set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination. A 2-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of an American president. And then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out. And if you listen to this 4-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination date.
Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. Robert Bickell, and he is an investigator, and he has been investigating this whole issue going back to 1989, and, of course, the Iraqi connection and the terrorist connection, and how so much of this ties together. Now, those of you who have studied anything about this explosion that took place in Bali about a week ago, if you've seen anything, it involved an ammonium nitrate and diesel bomb with TNT. Now, that's pretty much exactly what Ramzi Youssef used to set off his bombs, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. He did some amazing things with chemicals. Several years ago, when I was in school, I worked for an oil field service company for a semester. And I was trained, you know, as an explosives rigger in the oil field. And we had to become very, very well qualified with a number of different types of explosives and things of that nature. And the chemistry of it, of course, you know, that just kind of went with the territory. It went with the job. It also was, you know, part of my education where I was studying engineering to begin with. But, you know, the things that I've seen that Youssef did in his bombing practices, then here recently we saw that there was this tape that was released, and CNN carried a great deal of coverage on how they were having classes in how to prepare chemical explosives using chemicals that are relatively freely available on the open market, whether it's here in the United States or anywhere else in the world. And this was what Ramzi Youssef was doing. He was manufacturing his own explosives and pretty high concentration explosives that would give him the extra boost to go with the ammonium nitrate that he would use as the bulk of the explosives.
And, of course, now here he is working with Terry Nichols in 1991, and then, of course, he was working with Nichols again in 1994 and 1995, wasn't he?
Right. He was actually, Terry Nichols, Mike Johnson and I had conversations early on where we discussed things that we felt were probably pretty much the case as to who was doing what to who.
Well, who was doing what to who, and what part did Timothy McVeigh and, of course, Terry Nichols play in this Islamic radical plot to blow up our buildings?
Well, the deal with Nichols was already pretty much round the bend anyway. When he left the military, telling one of his compadres, one of his bunk mates or whatever, that he was going to return to Fort Riley someday recruiting his own army. He already had a very anti-government mentality very well established in his behaviors, in the way he conducted himself. You know, and ultimately he went on to disavow his citizenship and a number of other strange things. But what, you know, what this boy was doing was so far around the bend that, you know, his family should have recognized some of it even at that time. But actually, when he went to the Philippines, he fell into an open pit full of Islamic fundamentalists and people who were associated with them in organized crime operations. And quite honestly, I am still quite unsettled at the fact that we cannot find the reason why he went to the Philippines. That's something that I've not been able to find, and I've talked to people all over the country, interviewed people. Craig Roberts has interviewed people all over the country. I've had several interviews with Stephen Jones. He was telling me about one particular national news group that spent 4 months, untold amounts of dollars and significant resources, trying to determine if Terry Nichols was actually involved with any of the militia groups or the neo-Nazis in this, you know, first one and another. And we can't find it. Well, I can't find it.
For our listeners, Stephen Jones was, of course, Timothy McVeigh's attorney and really one of the best informed people about this. And he wanted to bring all this out of the trial. He knew about Terry Nichols. He knew about the Islamic radicals. And, of course, the judge, Judge Mates, would not allow this to be brought out. And to this date, everything is being done to keep the American people from understanding the Islamic connection. You would think that right now the administration would be jumping all over this. Here's a reason to go after Saddam Hussein. He attacked America. We can justify it. And yet, of course, they're not telling the people. And the question is why.
One of the things that I have a problem with on a number of those issues, and it's not with the premise that we're not being told the truth, because I know we're not being told the truth. The problem, before Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh ever went to trial, before anything ever came about, there was a significant investigation going on in the Philippines because of the bombing of Philippine Airlines Flight 434. In December of 1994. Then Ramzi Yousef and Hakeem Murad and Wali Khan, Hakeem Murad made a mistake of washing his hands in the wrong sink where he had been mixing chemicals, and it created a chemical reaction that started a fire. That led to his arrest and the arrest of Wali Khan Amin Shah, who was one of their other cohorts.
And, of course, the capture of the laptop computer that told about Operation Bajinka.
Right.
And the plan to bomb the World Trade Center with a hijacked airplane.
That's true. But what a lot of people do not know is that the same FBI agents who had been involved in the investigation of the first World Trade Center bombing were sent to the Philippines. I've got those two agents' names. I will not mention them over the radio because I believe both of them to be honest, integrity field agents who worked themselves silly trying to figure out what was going on, but they had superiors to report to.
And, of course, those superiors weren't interested in finding out what was going to go on, or at least letting the American people know what was going on.
Right. But what ultimately transpired was that the level of investigation that was conducted in the Philippines with regard to the bombing of PAL Flight 434, investigation that was being conducted when Hakeem Murad was arrested, they didn't even realize then that Ramzi Yousef was the bomber that took, or you know, that bombed the airline flight. Less than 30 days later, Murad is arrested on January the 11th of 95. That investigation into that airline bombing was still taking place with American agents in place. We also have a statement that shows that there were FBI agents on the ground with the team that secured that apartment of Ramzi Yousef, Hakeem Murad, and Wali Khan, and had immediate access to that computer.
And, of course, the interesting thing is Terry Nichols comes home immediately after Murad is arrested. My understanding is he had a round-trip ticket, but he forgot about the round-trip ticket. He wanted to get out of there so quickly. And, of course, then in April of that year, 1995, we have the bombing of the Murrah Building.
Right. And what had transpired was that during that period of time is also when Edwin Angeles was brought in for debriefing. See, he was the public story that was told was that he surrendered and was one of the terrorists that they've been looking for forever. In actuality, he'd been providing intelligence reports to his military and Filipino National Police handlers on a regular basis. Those reports were also made available to the Federal Bureau of Investigation between February of 1995, February, March, April, and May of 1995. It was 4 months that Edwin Angeles was in Manila at Camp Crane at the Philippine Intelligence Command Center under intense debriefing and what is referred to as tactical interrogation.
I understand that when they let him go, he said, if you let me go, I'll be killed, and he walked out and he was killed.
Well, he was killed somewhat after that. When they let him go in May of 1995, they put him back on the street, and he was back to work as a intelligence agent for them on the ground in the Philippines.
All right.
The work that he did between May of 1995 and November of 95 resulted in the arrest of 35 terrorists, one of which was Ramzi Yosef's brother. And it was actually three complete separate terrorist cells that were arrested and taken into custody.
Well, now, when was Angeles assassinated?
He was assassinated in 98.
Okay, fine. Why didn't they protect him?
He became a more of a liability than he was an asset. They had burned him, and they burned him publicly by parading him out in front of people and announcing, you know, who he was.
And, of course, that was his death sentence.
Right. And so at that point, he actually asked two separate Filipino senators for protection.
Right. And nobody was going to protect him. He had given his life for his country, and now sayonara.
Right. And so, you know, consequently, it became a situation where he was assassinated walking across the Central Plaza in Basilan, in a little community down there where he and his wife were staying at the time. She was pregnant with their child, about 8 months pregnant. And she had seen him coming out of the mosque where he went to pray on Friday. And she was coming out of a little grocery store kind of across the square a little ways. And when she was walking toward him, by all accounts, what amounts to two individuals who probably were working for the Filipino government or some portion of some rogue element of the government, walked up and shot him point-blank range and killed him, where he died right there in that plaza. But what survives, and the back to the question that I was talking about that needs to be asked, the FBI is not going to give up the information on what they know about Oklahoma City. The FBI is, and the CIA and the NSA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, none of the four of them are going to give up what these congressmen and senators are looking for is a smoking gun. The reality of it is that we have the names of the FBI agents that were conducting the investigations. And those are the investigative files that need to be asked for and subpoenaed specifically by the United States Congress and by Senator Specter's office with the United States Senate.
We're out of time. We're going to have to get you back for a two-hour evening. Would you come back again sometime?
I certainly will any time that you would care to have me.
God love you. Thanks so very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, fine. Well, I hope that our listeners have enjoyed what you've heard, and that's just part of the story. We've had Bob with us before, and I learn a great deal more every time I hear from him. Pray for America. We're in real trouble because the government is covering up the truth once again. Pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Hope you can make our meeting on the 23rd of November. Until then, may the Lord be with you.
Okay. What guy?
The tree guy.
Oh, the Phil Fairhill?